We might as well kick off. Afternoon on the last day, as Jules just mentioned. Thank you all for coming. Today it's my very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Jules Gribble. Jules has over 25 years' experience and is a Director of Enterprise Risk Metrics. Enterprise Metrics.
I'll have the risk metrics if I can get it, but that's a bit bigger.
I've just augmented the company name. That's based in Melbourne. In addition to his established pursuits in professional practice, which include unit pricing, operational risk and the like, and professional education, he has a long-standing interest in supervision and regulation. Recently, Jules has had the opportunity to undertake an assessment of an insurance supervisor in Pakistan against the IAIS insurance core principles as part of a World Bank project. That must have been interesting.
Yeah, it's a bit different.
I hope you got to see a bit of cricket while you were there. And also...
there's a hell of a lot of people there.
Also potential for work in microinsurance. And this work... part of a project led by Eamon Kelly, led to some interesting findings that will be shared to you in this session. So,
that was last session.
Oh.
You got the wrong bit of paper.
I've got a wrong bio here. Oh, well. Well, there you go. Well, let me say, and I know this is true, that Jules is a member of the... he's a member of the Institute. he's a member of council and is a chair and sits on several institute committees, including the Life Insurance Wealth Management Practice Committee and the FCR Task Force. So today we're going to have a presentation for 20 minutes and then discussion after then. So please welcome Jules.
Thanks, Darren. Sorry about that. Well, what I want to do is talk a bit about op risk and actuaries, and if we get time, which we might not, because I'm renowned for staying on time, talk about the opportunities and what I see as some of the significant risks to the profession about getting involved with op risk. Let me preface that by saying that I think operational risk is an opportunity for the profession, and we should be taking it up potentially much more strongly than we are. In the context that I want to talk about a little bit toward the end, which is out of the FCR working group, it's a superannuation context. It's a great need for it there. The dangers are that we as a profession overcomplicate it. Right? It's not that hard in some of this stuff. And the challenge is we have to go and give value to the clients. It's not whether we think it's value, it's whether they think they got value. And it's a really important part of going into an area that's new, not in our statutory castle. All right, we don't have to be there. And there's competition. Okay, so those are the options are we can do it. The risk is we do it wrong. So just it's a bit of a primer here, I guess, but especially if this is going to work for me, which it's not. Let's try a different mouse. Oh, come on, guys. On the where? That one?
To the right.
There?
All the way off.
All the way off. Oh, there, that?
Yeah.
Ah. What happens then?
And then
it should start up. Look at that. Come on. Oh, okay. All right, now we're in business. Does this work? Does this work? Obviously not. Does that work? Oh, good. All right.
We're experiencing an operational risk, right?
Exactly. We planned this. This is intentional, you know. Now, this was deliberate. Anyway, so, first point, what is operational risk? Now, I'm a bit staggered, to be honest, that you have to keep going through this because this is a well-established definition. It comes from Basel II and banking. It's very generic. But you still find people who argue about it and they want to call it operations risk and they want to put bits in and out. You know, my view is this is an established definition. Let's work with it. So what have we got? Risk of loss, one-sided, unfortunate, but there you go. Inadequate or failed internal processes, people or systems. That gives you a lot of scope. and then you can add in external events as well. And the definitions usually include legal risk, which is costs of legal suits and all those things, and it excludes a few other things, mostly because of the point, and even potentially now no one knows how to quantify them anyway. Okay, so, but even allowing for that, we've got a number of things. So these, again, are the Basel loss types. All right, there are seven of them. I've just put them into people, processes, systems, and external events. It doesn't take all that long. But what I want you to do is to look at these for a minute and go, whether I'm in banking, whether I'm in insurance, whether I'm in superannuation, internal fraud, I'm going to go, yep, seen that. Employment practices, seen that. Clients, products, and business practice, yep, messed that up. Execution, delivery, and process management. There's a few EUs around about that, various places all across the board. Business systems, IT always works, all right, so we know that. External fraud, yep, seen that. You know, as a matter of curiosity, identity theft, I saw this a couple of years ago. Cost of identity theft is considered to be something like 2 to 4% of the GDP. Big numbers, all right? Seeing that? Damage to physical assets, nothing ever goes wrong. No floods, no nothing. This is not to do with banking. This is a generic type thing which we can all take. As you move across the various disciplines, the priorities might move a bit, but the basic things are all there. This is the high-level categorisation. You can drive down in this as deep as you want. I don't want to go there particularly because you then run into all sorts of classification problems and is it in this bucket or is it in that bucket and all that stuff. And that's important to deal with in a practical sense, but right now it's not particularly. Am I going down here? So I then wanted to put this in a little bit of context, and I found a very nice paper, and I'm just trying to get this in your minds about how important this is. So I've gone through the various pieces, right? Nothing banking related to them potentially. Some people did some work, European banks, 2003. The threshold for losses was 10,000 euros units. Now the thresholds are actually important because if you don't get all the little stuff in the distribution, you end up with different distributions if you're not careful doing the modelling. So thresholds are important if you're doing modelling. So that's what that was. The key point is there was a number of banks and it was the same threshold. And they had about 600 events and they looked at the losses and, you know, this is for the actuaries here. So they fitted the frequency to a Poisson distribution, which is pretty standard. And these guys used the Pareto distribution for the severity. Doesn't really matter, but it's a heavy-tailed distribution, which is what operational risk is. So what are the interesting things that came out of this? Well, remember we're in 2003, so you can double all these numbers or so for inflation, even in the EU. And the interesting thing is there's about a bit under two events over $1 million or 1 million units for operational risk happening. So one or two per institution. So not common, but not all that uncommon. And it's about one over 10 million, one real biggie. I think it was 63 events out of 65 institutions. Gives you a feel for what's happening at sort of the average institutional level. So, and I want to focus on the contrast between the number of events and the cost. Right? So the cost up here. Here's the number of events, the 1 million and the 10 million. This, I think, is stunning. So what you have is 80% of the events number, you know, up to 50,000. This is not earth-shattering stuff. Go down to the bottom, over 10 million, 0.2%, 50% of the costs. That's what happens when you have heavy-tailed distributions. So when we're talking about operational risk and costs and all that stuff, you know, you're only interested in this bit down here. Right out in the extreme tail of what's going on. And extreme tails are really hard to model because fundamentally, when you come to doing it, they're mathematically unstable. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But I think that 50% in the bottom right-hand corner, that's an eye-opener. Right? And if you use a different long-tail distribution, it'll move around a little bit, but basically it's always going to look the same. So we've defined operational risk. What I want to do now is to stop and think about it. I'm going to offer you the thesis that operational risk actually has some intrinsic differences from other types of risk. First point is, most of it's not new. Occupational health risks were there. They've been there for quite a long time. Okay? Fraud risks have been there for quite a long time. So this is not, a lot of this stuff isn't new. What is new is the approach that we're taking to managing it. All right? Building the models or building the processes around it. Second point, it's unavoidable. All right? The old traditional risk management method of avoid, it's not an option. You want to be in business, you've got operational risk. No upside. Right? There's no gains to doing this well, it's just avoiding losses. It's entity specific. Right? Different entities have different cultures, different processes, all those things. Therefore, you've got different opportunities to mess it up in. So it's entity specific. The issue about aggregating data over entities is a really big, difficult issue. The data you get is not independent, it's not stationary in the true sense of stationary. So an event that happened 10 years ago for X dollars isn't necessarily going to be equivalent to an event that happens today for X dollars or X dollars plus inflation, because the environment in which it happened is different. So be very careful. You might have the data, but you might not have a lot of information. There's breadth and disparity of aspects. It covers a wide range of stuff. They're coming from different sources, different distributions. Heterogeneity. All our actuarial models go homogeneity. So this is tough. Fundamental role of culture. I've alluded to that about being entity specific. But different people react to different things. And as your residual risk profile changes, as you put in different mitigants, you put in better risk controls, the environment in which risk occurs changes as well. The whole thing is a moving feast. All right? So it's different. The first thing that people tend to focus on is they tend to focus on operational risk, regulatory capital. All right? So I'm going to talk a bit about that first. I want to come back to that because I actually don't think that's the main game. It's just a fun game. So what do you put into operational risk capital? Well, there's a variety of types of losses. You can talk to various people. We've got known knowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns and all those sorts of things. But I've split them up slightly differently. Expected stuff, right? Stuff that happens small frequently. It's business as usual. I gave the person the wrong change by 20 cents. You know, it comes up, it evens out. It's often in the budget. There's just a little slush item line there. It's not really op risk, okay? It's just nuisance value. You put in place processes to manage. If you mess it up, it's bad, but it's not really it. You then have things that you might call unexpected losses, right? You're not planning on them. You don't know there's going to be 25 of them. You kind of like them to be none, but you know that over a bit of time, they're going to come and get you, right? You're going to make a mistake making an insurance payout. You're going to make a mistake with something else. Not very many of them, but you're going to do it. So they're not business as usual, but there is enough of them to have a statistical base. Right? You can do statistics on them. You can do averages on them. You can do sample means and variances and all that stuff. But you've got to have enough of them to be able to do that. So really big ones that happen really infrequently, you have an issue about whether you've got a statistical group or not. A lot of tools fall away if you haven't got a statistical group. Then at the end of it, there's a certain few of these things where you just go, if it happens, it happens. All right, this is if someone drops a bomb on my house and I'm dead type stuff. They're so big and so infrequent that you actually start needing to drop them out. Why? Because I'll come back to it in a second. It's the mathematical instability that does it. And also, these things here, these are absolutely entity-ending issues. You don't really care because your entity's dead. All right. So there's an end piece that you think about dropping out. Okay, so where's op risk come from? Well, thank you, Mr. Basel. All right, about 10 years ago, Basel regulators, Basel II, moved on to Basel III now, they said, we're going to make banks hold explicit capital for operational risk. Banks all went, we're really interested in operational risk now because it's going to cost us something. And that was the change that came through. It's regulator-driven change. And what it did was it drove, and I think this is misguided, but it drove in general a focus on building models so that you could work out how much operational risk capital you had to hold. because you had to do it. Nothing wrong with building models, right, by the way, although there are some debates about whether they're any good or not. But it is the focus on models, I think, is misguided. Right? The focus on capital by itself is misguided. Well, if you go and actually read the Basel II stuff, which is Basel II is a big document, but if you read the bit about operational risk, it's only about 10 or 15 pages. You know, you can do it before you fall asleep. But it lines up two pieces. It lines up doing the model, so I'll talk a bit more about those, and it lines up what it calls qualifying standards. Those qualifying standards are governance things that you need to put in place before you're allowed to have the regulatory capital used, right? Particularly if you go for the more sophisticated things. So what I have is I've got in parallel, I've got capital and governance. I'll leave you with the thesis. The key thing about op risk is the governance bit. It's about governance and it's about processes. I'll leave you with that. Solvency II, which we're starting to see come in Australia, it's called LAGIC here to disguise it, it's basically following the same path. We're seeing LAGIC 2 coming in. It talks about getting regulatory capital. Some people are out there building op-risk models to get regulatory capital in insurance. Necessary but not sufficient. Superannuation, right? We're seeing APRA from the Stronger Super stuff. We're actually seeing the operational risk reserve has got a Guernsey. Now, the big thing in the superannuation environment, of course, is it's now established that you can write by this and everybody agrees this will be bigger than zero, which was a significant gain compared to maybe 3 months ago or 6 months ago, because then there were plenty of people who were going, oh, zero's good. Okay? And you only have to start thinking about this for a moment to realise zero is probably not a very good answer. All right? But it's very new. It's very much, it's a bit like in the banking environment, they've had a couple of rounds of doing op-risk. It's a bit like a toddler before they get to school, I think. They can run around a bit, they get bruised, they get up, they do it again, and so on. In insurance, I think we might be at the stage of learning to walk. All right? There are no approved models for internal models, which is the big version in insurance in Australia yet. There are a couple that are on the way, no doubt, and there will be some, but there's none there now. In superannuation, we're at newborn. We actually understand it exists. We know it's out there. We know it's going to come, but it hasn't done a lot of damage yet. So this is a new area across the board. And don't think the banks have got it all sorted. So I think if there's anybody here from banking, you can correct me or not. But my understanding is if you're talking to banking people, they're going, yeah, we can build models, but we're not too sure about the answers, and we're not too sure on the governance bit, and we haven't got it integrated into the businesses yet, and it's not second nature to everybody, which is where it ought to be. So there's a long way to go. So this means opportunity. So basic approaches. This is how Basel II works. It's essentially how LAGIC works, and it's a sensible way to go. So what do you do at the beginning? Still stuck with capital, by the way. I'll come back to governance. At the beginning, you make as simple as you can. So you find a single proxy measure, like premium or funds under management or something like that, which you can get from the accounts, and you go and find a percentage to multiply it by, preferably given to you by the regulator so you don't have to think about it, so somebody else does the job, and you multiply it out, that's it. All right, that's your reserve. So it's blunt, it's simple, it's top down, big virtue, it's doable. All right, and it's bigger than zero. Next one, they come to what's called standard, by a variety of words for these things. But so here you go, well, this is too simple. We're actuaries. And where other people will make it more complicated. So what you now do is you go, well, we better reflect the business a bit. So you pick out a number of business lines. Now, this is a standardised model for op risk in banks. You've got a number of different business lines. So they've now got a number of proxies, if you like. And I multiply them each by their very own percent, because that makes it more complicated. And I add them up and I'm done. All right, so blunt, simple, top down. Some entity reflection, but not really. And then you come to the thing, you go, that's all how. We don't want people doing that. We'll allow people to do the advancement. That's called build an internal model. And now we're into a whole new game. So internal models, and this is really interesting because internal models suddenly mean that from a regulatory perspective, you're doing something completely different than what you used to do. In the good old days before internal models, what happened was the regulator specified the model. It was called look up the legislation and find out what the rules are. And you went and did it. There might be a bit of debate about how you actually exactly did it, but in principle, the regulator specified the model and you implemented it. When you have advanced models like this, regulator doesn't specify the model. You do. Regulator's job is not, you know, what's the model. Regulator's job is, do I believe you? It's an entirely different exercise. Not comfortable for regulators. Anybody who's done work with models and someone, you know, your job is to assess a model. That's hard. But it's very different. So that's where we are with internal models. So how do we do that? Well, internal models. First up, we're right out in the tail. Banks are 99.9%. 1 in 1,000. Right? You're out in the extreme of the tail. Insurance, you're at 99.5. We're not quite so extreme, but pretty close. All right. Tails are really hard things to do. Tails flap around. All right. Small, very small changes in parameters will produce relatively large changes in tails. Right? If you don't believe it, go and get something like a log normal distribution. Put it out to the tail, make a 1% change in one of the parameters and see how big the percentage changes in, you know, the 99th percentile. It'll be 10, 20, 50 times as big. All right? If you want to get a feel for it. That's mathematically unstable. I'm not doing anything different or special. I'm just putting it into that log normal distribution and it will move the end a lot. Right? That's where I say it's mathematically unstable. It's just a fact of life. You reflect the entity, business and operational risk management. Well, this is good. Very specific. Now, how do you do it? Good question. Complicated and expensive. Someone said to me anecdotally, you know, a little while ago, big four banks in Australia probably spend $1 billion bringing in internal models over the last 5 to 10 years. That's a lot of money. Right? That pays for a lot of this and a lot of this. So if you aren't going to be big and do it, you know, you're up to plan B. The big challenge is integrating regulatory capital with the business use. You've only done regulatory capital to keep the regulator happy. Forget about how the business runs for the moment. And actuaries do make a contribution, I have to say, but I wouldn't have said they were dominant in this area. And you've got to go, you know, the traditional standard approach is a loss distribution approach. Some of the old documentation says the actuarial approach of loss distribution approaches. We go, yeah, we can do this. Yeah, but we're not. So how does this work? Simply take a frequency for the distribution for the frequencies, take a distribution for the losses, take a convolution, which we all learn how to do in part one, at least in theory, look at the outcome distribution, pick the number you like, and away you go. Right, the 99.9 percentile here. This is normally done by simulation because most of the time you can't get closed form answers for those of the mathematicians amongst you, but you know, if it takes time, buy a bigger computer. Right? This hides a whole raft of complexities and places where you can fall down. How many people in Australia are going to do this? I don't know, maybe six banks or so? Six, maybe seven? Don't know. I think there are six. You've now got AMA approval for OPRIS, and that's probably about as far as it's going to go. I reckon there'll be less than five insurers who'll even try this. Everybody else has to do something else. So, and including superannuation, they aren't going to do loss distribution models. So I've just made a couple of observations here. When you talk about this, just to understand the complexity, they talk about internal data, that's yours. External data, that's somebody else's, but is it valid? They talk about having scenarios, which are get groups of experts together and work out what would happen if. And they all talk about the business environment, internal controls. That's the environment within which you work. They all interact. They're all difficult to deal with. Right, and I've read a couple of things recently that the argument is, in terms of doing LDA models, 80% of the difficulties lie with the data. 20% of the difficulties lie with the mathematics. You can deal with the mathematical ones. It's the data that will get you. And the risk, of course, is the very famous thing, garbage in, garbage out. World's best model with the wrong data still produces the wrong answer. All right? And in this sort of context, you actually have to know, have some way of deciding whether you believe or not, whether it's right or wrong. So it's not even knowing it's wrong is the issue. A couple of comments here, because I want to be a little bit even-handed about operational risk governance. And this is actually taken from one of the BIS documents. It's a summary. But this is the bit that goes in parallel with building the model. This governs the use of the model. So go have a framework. We're familiar with that. Embedded, this is whether or not you actually use the knowledge you get from the model in the practice of the business. Right? So whether the op risk analysis is actually being used by anybody or not. Do the business and strategic plans reflect it? Have the business plans and strategic plans actually met operational risk or not? Board endorsement. Right? So someone's paying attention. Can you monitor it? Got processes. Can you show how it's been implemented? Right? Does it reflect both internal and external risks so that you don't have the argument, oh, well, it's external, so I don't have to worry about it? Is there a linkage to performance management? Explicit linkage, not, you know, we'll talk about it later. And are there updates and so on? These are all processes that sit around the model and the use of it. And they're absolutely necessary. They're not necessarily complicated and expensive to put in place. Supervisory point of view goes in three bits. This is now going to be pretty much true across banking, insurance, superannuation for all bits. But pillar one is entity has a crack at it, makes up its number. Pillar two is regulator reviews it, and if they don't like it, they change it. So there's a little bit of discussion going on here. And pillar three is some form of disclosure to the market, because the argument is that market discipline will drive people to be good. That presumes they understand what's coming out. All right, but the key point I want to make is even if you're building models, you're dealing with op-risk, you do it within the organisation by whatever you do, there is a review stage here. And APRA retains the right, if they don't like your answer, for good reason, to be fair, but they will come back and they'll have a little discussion with you and take you out to the back lane for a cup of coffee. And the net result will be that this one wins. Okay, but there's an interaction there. And I think we need to remember that. I want to just talk about solvency. I want to try and bring this back into sort of more traditional actuarial context. So the actuaries love talking about solvency. So I thought it's just useful to go and get a definition. Everybody's happy. Acceptable level of the likely. You're going to stick around. You know, in superannuation, insurance, for a long time, preferably. But it's got three key components. And this, I think, does bear some thinking about when you come to talk about op risk. Risk management, okay? That's preventative. It's what you do in order to, you know, hopefully reduce, avoid, mitigate things happening. It's before the event. Perfectly good stuff to do. Liquidity, it's a good idea to be able to pay up on time. So we've seen liquidity come up in other issues. That's also, in terms of planning, that's preventative. The bottom one is capital, or capital adequacy, whichever way you like to look at it. Capital is curative. Capital is what you use after the risk event has happened and you're paying out on it. The idea, conceptually at least, is you don't get here. The idea is to fix it here. This is the backstop. So if you're going to talk about solvency, you know, and existence of organisations, you can't talk about any one of these in isolation. You certainly can't go and talk about capital, particularly regulatory capital, in isolation. Talking about operational risk, you better be talking about this to some extent as well. So these guys all interact with each other. And you know, as you would expect, if you put in better risk management processes, you would expect to be able to see capital go down as a consequence. Otherwise, your process isn't very responsive. All right. This one I've covered off, so I'm not going to do there. Stop there. Superannuation, I want to step back now a little bit and talk about super, because this is a big opportunity and it's new. So we're a little bit past this slide because I did this before last Friday. Darren will testify that last Friday APRA changed the game rules a bit. It doesn't really matter. OPRIS are proposed by APRA, correct. They are going to be specifics, they're going to be flexible. RSE licensee responsibility, correct. Still is, more so than it was. APRA discussion paper from the end of last year proposed a 25 basis point minimum for op-risk reserves for super funds. They've now dropped that. Okay, it's up to the trustee to work out what's appropriate. Okay, more responsibility for the trustee. Separate operational risk reserve, yes, they've still got that. There are some details around exactly what you can and can't use it for, but I'm not going to worry about those. Very much a component of a broader risk management framework, still is the case. So it's integrated into the overall process, and there's no specific game rules, no specific methodology provided. All right, it's work it out yourself. So that's the state of play we are in superannuation. Although, as I said beforehand, one of the key things is we are at least at the point of bigger than zero. So I just, for all those people who run around in the superannuation industry, which is probably not in this room, and go, oh, we don't have operational risk. You know, it's not a problem for us. Talk to the banks. I'm going, yeah. Unit pricing errors. I don't know about you. I don't know, $150 million is the biggest, $60 million, the biggest one I know of. A couple are about $100 million. They haven't all gone away. Admin system failures? Never happens, right? There are some organisations building new admin systems. They're up to the third try at the moment. So first two tries, they're in that category. Mis-selling? Doesn't happen. You know, just go and check the ASIC website for EUs about mis-selling. Insurance, we always get that absolutely right. We never pay out the wrong amount. Nothing ever falls between the cracks. Okay, you don't have to have a lot of insurance mispayouts to build up a decent amount of money. Data integrity. All right, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, which may be some of you in the superannuation space, go and have a look at the ASFA ITM Data Integrity Index. It says on base data, which is like name, address, that kind of stuff, about 75% of the records they examine are absolutely correct. That leaves 25% to get wrong. Now, I'm not saying that 25% are necessarily going to lead you to a financial error or a big problem, but I'd be prepared to bet that some of them are. So data integrity. And everybody who's done a migration of a system or a merger knows that when you put a new system in, the easiest part is to get the data from the old system, you just whack it on the new system. And it always works. Right? So, data integrity. Product development. It's a big debate in superannuation about retirement products. So we certainly haven't got that one right. If you don't get it right, the punters will find something else to do. Outsourcing. Now, out of sight, out of mind. Try passing that one across to APRA. Fraud, negligence, misconduct. There's a couple of super funds who've had their boards intervened with by APRA recently in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. Commercial nominees. I'm sure you can think of a few others. So don't tell me that op-risk doesn't happen and won't happen in superannuation. It has and it will. So superannuation, just reserves, right? Many funds actually hold reserves, not necessarily for operations, but many funds do, about half. Recent APRA data, you might be interested to know, is that 53% of funds do not hold reserves. Now, by reserves, APRA in this document mean unallocated member assets to members. Okay, so you might debate the definition, but unallocated assets. Essentially, half do and half don't. When they do hold it, it's 50 basis points for defined contribution. Funny about that, isn't it? 50 basis points is the least accurate number between 0 and 1. Okay? So 50 basis points. That's not an unreasonable back-of-the-envelope number. More industry funds hold reserves than retail funds. It's about 80% to 40%. And industry funds actually, when they do hold them, hold a higher average than retail funds. Now, I'm not arguing about the causes or the validity of it. I'm just making the point that out there in superannuation fund land, you know, op-risk reserves, they're on the radar. So that gives us a little bit of context. So I'm going to leave you with, as Eamon said in the last presentation, you've got to have some numbers in an actuarial presentation. Well, I haven't got numbers because I don't like numbers in presentations, but I have got a formula, and hopefully that will sort of count. So what I'm suggesting is an appropriate op risk approach for superannuation. And this is in the Institute's submission to APRA of last December when they responded to the discussion paper. Is that what you do is you get a complicated formula. So you decide on a couple of proxies for operational risk. So in funds, it might be funds under management. It might be number of transactions as opposed to number of members. Whatever, you know, you sit down and work a couple of them out. And there'll be some consensus emerge over time to be, you know, sensible about it. For each one of those, you multiply them by a proxy, a percentage. So 10 basis points, 20 basis points, whatever it comes out to be reasonable. And then you add it all up, and away you go. That is a very manageable formula from a process point of view. So you reflect the business structure because these proxies would reflect it, and you make sure these proxies are chosen from a range. And by putting a range in place, you allow the recognition of individual entities. As your governance is better, you would move down the sliding bar. As your governance gets worse, you move up the bar. APRA have a review and all that good stuff. So that's the proposal the Institute put in play. I've got a couple of things here about actuarial contributions, which is we're clever and good and we can do it. So we'll skip that. Would like just to make the observation here, big opportunities. Everybody's got up risk. Right? Forget financial services, everybody's got it. Some really good at managing it, by the way. Next time you fly on the airline, just think about the probability of the operational risk of the airplane falling out of the air. It's pretty damn small. The airline's pretty good at some of this. So are miners. They don't tend to kill a lot of people in their big explosions. So, you know, other people have done a lot of good work here. It's new. We can learn from other professions. We can also contribute to them. This is about actuaries acting as team players, not solving the world's problems all in isolation. So perhaps that should be in the challenge bit. And I've got two challenges for this. Now, these are serious dangers in my view. Others may disagree, particularly in the superannuation context. The danger is that op risk management gets put into the another necessary regulatory compliance nuisance category. If we get, or in general op risk gets there, we've lost the opportunity because then we're coming in under duress. We're a nuisance. So our challenge is, as a profession, is if we do this stuff, we better make sure the client sees some value for it. The second one is, and I think this is a natural actuarial trait, we always want to make the answer better. My view is, don't overcomplicate it. I'll even leave you with the suggestion that, or the observation that, the numbers are a means to an end. The numbers are not an end in their own right. It's what you do with them that counts. So it's all about the process and the advice that you give as a consequence of the numbers. It's not about the numbers themselves. All right? This, I think, for actuaries, I know for me, this is a real challenge because I can just make it a bit better. I can just make it a bit more responsive. Well, the answer is don't bother. Okay, and that's it.
Okay, everyone, please thank Jules in the usual way. Now, we have time for a couple of questions. If you can please come to the microphone and say your name. The session is being recorded. So, any questions? Well, I might lead with one then. Jules, you mentioned regulatory capital that insurers and banks don't actually rely on their internal models for setting the capital. They use the prudential standards as what they hold.
Not exactly. They have the option.
They have the option, yes. But most actually just go for the standard.
Yeah, if you're not an advanced bank, then you're going to have to use one of the other ones, which is a formula.
So I guess with risk appetite and the new rules that APRA have about risk appetite, in formulating risk appetite, you have to do some modelling, don't you? You have to have you model your tolerances by having the likely impact and the probability.
Well, you would if you if you abide those new rules now. But if you go back from the banking perspective, what you end up with is you're using one of those base approaches. Mm. You've got a very blunt instrument over here, and you've got a risk appetite instrument over here that's significantly more sharp, for want of a better word. So there's an interplay that happens here and there. And there's also the other exercise is the interplay between economic capital, what you really want to hold, which will be tied to your risk appetite as well, versus the regulatory one, which is what you've got to hold.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Sorry.
You mentioned that trustees may have to uphold a minimum level of capital for superannuation funds. What happens if they go under an IRB, so an advanced approach, where the models do get complicated? Would that still be a reasonable expectation?
A couple of observations here. One is it's not clear what's going to happen because we're just sort of finding our way along. What's happened at the moment is APRA has said that the game plan is you set for super funds, you set a target level for op risk reserves, op risk capital, forget reserve capital debate. If you then fall below that target by coming across some lower level tolerance, you then go into replenishment mode. And you've got to work out a replenishment plan in a reasonable time. That's equitable sort of stuff. So the answer is you can fall down a certain level. If you cross that minimum bar, you're into replenishment time. How long that takes, what drives it, where you set that bar, all those things are yet to be determined. And in a sense, common practice is yet to evolve. Now, you might suspect that that threshold bar might be set, I don't know, I'm guessing now, 75 or 80% of the total, let's say, to allow for a bit of messing around. You might expect that the replenishment time would be, on average, something like 3 years, which would be consistent with the transition phase that's coming in. You might, as a fund, be able to argue that it's a really big event, so I need 5 years, you know, and that may or may not work. But all those things are there, waiting to evolve. But they're all going to be from a mathematical structural point of view, at the moment they're going to be pretty simple. And I think that's a good thing. The difficulty or the challenge is actually the governance and process that goes around getting to those simple numbers.
We'll leave it there. Please thanks, Jules Goodwin.